I'm Kate Bowler, and this is Everything Happens. I'm a historian, author, aggressively fast walker. But lately, in a world that promises endless progress, even now in a pandemic, I've realized I just need to be a person. It's hard to give up on the feeling that the life you want is just out of reach, if only you tried. Eat this food, find that relationship, just get the kids graduated or the parents this kind of care. Only then will I feel different, better, whole. But that's not the way this works. When I was 35, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And here's the very fun thing about that. The world loves you better when you are shiny, when you are cheerful, when you still believe that your best life now is right around the corner. I've written multiple books on the history of the idea that you can always fix your life, so I'm going to be the one to say it. There are some things we can change and some things we can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. We can have beauty and meaning, community and love, and we will need each other if we're going to tell the truth. Life is a chronic condition, and there's no cure for being human. Sometimes there are stories about ourselves that just need to be true, even if they aren't. Take my great-grandmother, Marjorie Bebington, for example. She was born in England around 1904, but no one's exactly sure because she was daughter number 4, and there was such a fuss about what to do with her because her dad had plain run out of names for girls. Apparently, you can run out of names and of energy to pay attention to another fiddlin' female, or so her father called her. But my Gigi, as we called her, was a hell of a woman. She was tough and kind and didn't let anything stop her. She could be the custodian of an entire apartment block, take care of her entire family, sew and knit every piece of their clothing, and still make your lunch to order every day, bake it on the side, that kind of thing. She loved to smoke, even though she thought none of us knew. And when she finally got around to something she couldn't do, which is to say she was a deeply mediocre painter, she had a solution for that too. She went to the secondhand store and bought an oil painting. And then she found a matching color and painted her name right over the artist's signature in the bottom right-hand corner. Ta-da! I hung that one in my house until I got old enough to think, wait a minute, she really made some remarkable progress there. We are made of stories. We are up to our eyeballs in them. So what a joy that our guest today loves telling them. Our guest today is Academy Award winner Matthew McConaughey. He is the accomplished actor you may remember as your dreamy boyfriend, last chance lawyer, Wall Street guru, down-home stripper, prophetic detective, terrifying killer, elusive fugitive, heartbreaking drug dealer, or surfing god. He has been everyone, and most recently himself, in his number one New York Times best-selling memoir, Green Lights, which you absolutely must listen to on audiobook because I have never heard anyone having more fun in the studio. Sir, it is lovely to meet you.
Oh, I did have some fun in the studio. I sure did. I'm glad that comes across. I had a lot of fun putting the printed word to the page, too. But I'm glad that came across.
It did. It really did. It obviously made me realize that we have so much in common. You're an Academy Award winning actor, Texas gentleman and raconteur. And I'm a Duke professor from Manitoba who really enjoyed stage 4 cancer and is very concerned I'll die of empathy. But we both wrote books out of a deep hope that we have stories to tell our children. Things I wanted to tell my son, like, these are the truths I love. These are the lies I had to let go of. So I kind of thought that might be a fun way to have this conversation today about the stories that are true enough. Does that sound good?
Yes, it does.
Okay, awesome. Let's start with a truth that is true enough. You were Little Mr. Texas, 1977.
You doggone right I was. get out there, come out on a horse, answer some questions about the 4-H and how to handle a ranch and be a gentleman, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and doggone it, I've got a picture to prove it. There I am. I'm holding the trophy. And my mama put that picture after that 1977 Little Mr. Texas and Bandera. She puts that picture of me and my cowboy hat holding that trophy. And she puts it up in the kitchen from that day on. And every morning when I come to breakfast, she goes, look at you. She points the picture and says, "You are Little Mr. Texas." Yes, ma'am. Wow. I sure am. And she reminded me of it every single day. So that was 1977. I was 8 years old at that point. So let's fast forward to 2018, when I'm 48 years young. I come across that picture and something catches my eye. I look down at the little engraved plate on the trophy, and I'm like, let me zoom in on that. And I zoom in on it for the very first time. And you know what it said?
What?
Runner up.
That's so good.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, what, for 30 years, I went, I'm thinking I was a little misdirected. Would I be here now with the life I have if my mom had told me I was runner up? I don't know.
No way. No, sir. That was a gift from God. That was a gift of confidence. Did you call your mom right away?
Right away.
Yeah.
Mom. What? I said, I just be Little Mr. Texas. She goes, yeah, of course you're Little Mr. Texas. I go, I just took off the pictures on and zoomed in on the trophy. It says a runner up. She goes, oh yeah, that. Well, no, you're still Little Mr. Texas. I go, what, it says runner up? She goes, no, the guy who won, they were rich, had a lot of money, and they bought a real fancy suit for the kids. So that was cheating. You're Little Mr. Texas.
What's so good about that too is, like, one, she stuck with it. That is gumption. And two, I mean, the part of it that is the truest is, like, there is no one in the entire world like your kid. And so, like, of course, you were Little Mr. Texas to her forever.
It's, yeah, forever.
When my kid loves the story of when he was born, because he was born in the midst of a great deal of drama. And I love to, like, really drag it out, where he's always like, you know, I'm like, and that baby pushed and pushed. And every time he's, like, really getting worked up, he's like, but it was me. And every time I'll be like, but I didn't know that yet. And then at the very end, when he gets put in my arms and it's the big moment, then we look at each other and it was like lasers. Lasers, Mom. Lasers of love. And we knew it was you. It was you the whole time. Like, every time, that's it. Like, our kids are like no one in the world. All right, another truth. Your parents were deeply in love, but they weren't always married and they weren't always gentle. What complicated truth did you learn from your parents' love?
That every relationship with ourselves, with our loved ones, let's just talk spouses for now.
Yeah.
It's very subjective for how two people need to communicate.
Yeah.
They needed heavier resistance than I need to communicate.
Yeah.
My mother, who's 88 and is in the other room, but to this day, you bring up any of those stories where they fought and there were knives drawn, blood was drawn, fingers were broken.
Yeah.
To this day, without any sentimentality, it would be like, yeah, exactly. That's what I need to communicate. And you know what? All those fights with your dad, who was 6'4", 265 pounds, and I was 5'2", 100 pounds. Guess who started them? Me. I needed it. You know? And so we can choose to go, well, I don't want my relationship to be a hurricane in the middle of the Pacific Ocean like my parents did. Hence, divorced twice, married three times.
Yeah.
And the love always did win. If the love didn't win, then it would have been inverse. They would have been divorced three times, married twice.
Yeah.
It was a real example of can't live with you, can't live without you. And they also really liked, you know, they were creating what we all kind of want sometimes. They literally created extra honeymoons.
Yeah. And I imagine there is like a feeling of, like, the totalize. I mean, one of the things I think we all want is like the totalizing experience of someone else's love. Like, this is everything or nothing. Like,
right.
The rawness of that.
It's very scary to be thought of.
Yeah.
As the totalness of someone else's love as well. It's an awesome feeling, but I know, shoot, I've seen some people, and I've been victim of it myself, of maybe going down the wrong track with that. Meaning, yeah. I write about in the book about you know, if I think you're Wonder Woman and you believe I'm Superman, then can we ever live up to that? Is that fair?
Yeah.
That pedestal is awesome, but it also has its relativity with which, because I've seen, and I've done it before too, where I've held someone on a pedestal or let myself be held on such a pedestal that I was painting myself into a corner, or we were painting the relationship into a corner. Neither one of us were going to be able to live up to it.
Yeah.
It lost its humanity. It lost its cracks. It's lost its foibles. It lost its, ooh, we fell down. Let's try and get back up. But I hear you. Yeah. There is something to that all consuming love.
You described it too as, I remember it was, what was it like, close ups and
impressions.
That was lovely. Yeah. Can you tell me about those? I know my husband since we were 14, and, the way that you describe the beautiful intimacy that comes from like a long look at something, I thought that was a really beautiful account of love.
Yeah. Well, those are the things we need, the things that actually look good from afar, but better up close. The more we get to know them, the more high definition they are in.
Yeah.
Details we see, oh my gosh, this is compounding the beauty. But there's other relationships that are more like wants and desires, which are also, I think, both of these happen, I think, are healthy for a relationship to have different levels of these, you know. But the impression is from afar, you know, the impression I had of my now wife, Camilla, walking across that room, floating in my eyes the night I saw her for the first time and leaned forward. And it was only 5 seconds, moving right to left. And I leaned forward and without consciously thinking about it, I said, what is that? And I write about everything that I thought she was in that image. But that was an impression. It was an club. The club was foggy. I'd had a few drinks. She was 20 feet away.
Yeah.
You know, but there was but the beauty in that impression is that now that I've 15 years later, I've gotten to know her really well and got to the definition and got to the close up and looked at the details. Every single thing that I was an impression, the poetry that came to me from that full 5 second seeing her walk has turned out to be true. And then some.
Yeah.
Upon closer inspection. And that doesn't always happen. Sometimes impressions in our life, boy, it never gets better than that, than that hazy, you know, magic hour view and their silhouette. And boy, when you come in close, you're like, ooh, ooh, better from afar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then sometimes we get those things in our life, they're like, no, the closer they get, the more intimate and real they get, the more beautiful they actually become.
Yeah. And then that's the perfect Valentine. You're even better close up.
Right?
Yeah, but I love that you have both the mythology about love, like your wife is a mermaid, and also the granularity of it, that you're even great now that I can see your pores. It's nice.
Right. Yeah.
I think I like it, though. I think we need both a story about our love and the love itself. I think it makes it more fun.
Right. I'm with you. I mean, if it's just the definition.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Then you're the couple that's like, no, it was a Tuesday. No, that's not when it started. He didn't say it like that. Then you're, it's nice to have the gloss. The gloss is lovely too.
Well, and the gloss is, you know, gives some credit to lust as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Gives credit on the come and the go, the approach and the exit. Love to see, hate to see you go. Love to, you know, hate to, what is it? Hate to see you leave, but love to watch you go. It gives a little of,
you
know, keep chasing a little bit. I don't know everything. Hey, did you just do that? What? I've never seen you do that before. Or did you, you know, it's nice to have a little bit of mystery.
It is. Are you, I thought you were annoying, but now you're preternaturally graceful.
Yeah.
I would like to make this next question sound philosophical, and it is about a partial truth, but the truth is that I could not stop laughing at the story of your mom as a salesman for the facial product Oil of Pink. And frankly, I just need you to tell me about a partial truth that went bananas.
Well, so my mother, the queen of relativity, you know, you read the book, you see that, and she fits that bill. She had been selling this door-to-door, doing this door-to-door sales, this product called Oil of Mink.
Yeah.
And you put it on your face, and it just, it brings out all the impurities. So be prepared for the first, 10 days, because it will bring out some pimples or some impurities that you have your skin. But then what it's doing is pulling all of those impurities out that you would ever have. And it will leave you with glowing skin for the rest of your life.
It's beautiful.
Ta-da. Well, mom's selling this door to door. She's putting it on. Da, 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 da. I'm 14. I'm going through puberty, adolescence. I got a few pimples on my face. And all of a sudden mom goes, "Well, why don't you start applying the Oil of Mink?" I'm like, "Great idea." So I start putting on the Oil of Mink. Well, I start getting more pimples.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. More pimples, more pimples, more pimples. About 10 days into it, I'm like, "Mom, are you sure this is okay?" She's like, "Oh, Mom, let me have a look. Woohoo. Boy, you've got a lot of impurities." We call, a week after that goes by. Now we're almost 3 weeks in. We call the lady who got my mom, who's sort of the lady who ran the region or the whole area of Texas that my mom was peddling the Oil of Mink, to come over to the house. She has a look. I remember putting on her glasses, looking down her nose, looking at my face, going, "Oh my gosh, this is really working well. It's just bringing out all those impurities. Wow." And I'm like, "Are you sure?" And I'm like, "Yes, but you do have a lot of impurities." Now, got to about 5 days after that, where what's been happening is, I went from pimples to now my whole face is swollen pustules. I mean, I look like a different person. I washed my face with a washcloth. I mean, my face would bleed. It was those nasty words. Anyway, I'll say pus and blood. And it was like, "Oh my gosh, this is not right." But mom's going, "Stick with it." Well, I decided, you know what? I'm going to go get a second opinion. I talked to my buddy. I said, who had a dermatologist. And I said, "Just get me in there, man. I need to go see him." I go in there. I see this guy, and he looks at my face and he goes, "Matthew, what are you putting on your face? What product?" Well, I carried it with me. I pulled out this bottle of Oil of Mink, and he looked at the bottle and he goes, "Oh no, 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 no. This is like for people over 40 years old. You are in puberty right now. Your glands are excreting more oil. This has completely clogged your pores. Your pores cannot breathe. Nobody in their youth under the age of even 35 should be using this product. You've got to get off this now. He said, you are 2 weeks away from having the ice pick holes in your face that forever, that severe acne can bring. He goes, "We got to get you on Accutane," which is the thing that you're on it for a year. He goes, "It's going to dry everything out, but it's got a 95% chance of working." Well, I'm like, "Sign me up." I get on the Accutane. The side effects that come with that, the dandruff, the dry, the slits in the mouth, the aching joints, the hair loss. I did not care. That's fine. Just get rid of all these pimples, man, please. Well, it finally did clear them up. Now, what had happened while I had those pimples, why my face was really broken out, is my dad got the bright idea of going, "We ought to sue this company." He's like, "Look at you, son. It all swell up. Jeez, a man.
It's your mom. It kills me."
So, and mom's just paralleling this on the other side, never feeling an ounce of guilt, being like, "Well, yeah, okay, yeah, do that too."
Who did this to you?
So we go see he takes me to see his lawyer named Jerry Harris. And Jerry says, "Gosh, dog, look at him. Jeez, man, hey, he looks horrible." He immediately goes, I remember this, he goes, how's it been with that? Has your confidence dropped since you got all these pimples?" And I'm like, "Yes, sir." And I'm like looking at my dad. My dad's kind of raised his eyebrows like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And I'm starting to, even at that age, I was starting to get the line of this sort of prosecutorial thinking, and he was building his case. And all of a sudden he goes, after a long line, "You're not doing it. How are you doing with girls?" I'm like going, "Not good.
Terribly."
And he's like, "He goes, you under emotional distress, could I say?" And I'm like, and I look at my dad. My dad's like, kind of without saying it, going, "Say yes." I'm like, "Yes."
right? Emotional distress. And all of a sudden, Jerry goes, that's it. Emotional distress. That's our case. We can make $35,000 to $50,000 on this thing based on emotional distress. This company is irresponsible. There's not anything on this bottle that says a pubescent adolescent child should not take this and put this minkle on their face. So we're going to sue them $35,000 to $50,000. Mr. Jim, I guarantee we can get it. Well, as you know, court cases can take a while. So that was the initial idea. We're going to sue the company, make $35,000 based on emotional distress. But over that year, I took the Accutane, my face cleared up.
Yeah.
Only now that I'm a senior, it's a year and a half later, I'm now a senior in high school, and now I'm called back in for the deposition with the defense.
Yeah.
And he's this guy's sitting across the table from me, and he's looking at these pictures of my face all swollen up back when I had those pimples, and he's just going, oh my goodness, oh dear God, oh my gosh. And he looks up and he goes, this must have been so emotionally distressful for you, Matthew. And I'm in my mind going, are you kidding me? This guy just served me a softball. That's exactly our case. That's it. He's just feeding me. I'm going to knock this out of the park. I'm like, oh, yes, sir. Emotionally distressful. I mean, you know, I wasn't confident with the girls, and I wasn't confident. I was insecurity. I didn't cry. I mean, it was good. He's like, no, it's just basically, it's kind of just scarred you for life. I'm like, yes, it scarred me for life. He pulls this green, thick, big, hardback, leather-bound book from under the table. And he puts it on the table, opened it to an earmark page, turned it around, and pushes it in front of me. I immediately knew what this was. This was my senior year, the year I was in a class, what do you call it, book. What do you call the class?
Yearbook.
Yearbook. This is our yearbook. And I got a feeling I know where this is going. And he points to a certain picture on this page. He got flagged and he goes, who is that? I look down, and there is a beautiful girl with a sash around her chest that says, most beautiful. And hooked arm in arm to her is this young man with the sash across his chest that says, most handsome. And that was me. I immediately go like, oh, we lost it. We blew the case. And just as I went, oh, shit, I looked up at that guy and he goes, scarred you for life, huh? And I knew the case was over. And so that day, I remember my dad, him and Hall around the house going, God damn you, boy. You're going to make $50,000 off this company. You got to go off and win most handsome. You bring the whole case up. You screwed it up, son.
Oh my gosh. And the photo too, you look like a complete demigod. And I'm sure they're like, okay, sir. All right. I'm sure it was very difficult for you. Okay, well, you just absolutely made my life. I'm just wiping away tears. Thank you for telling me that. It could have been true though. It was almost true. Oh, you were temporarily scarred.
Yeah.
So, because we know each other very well, you know that I'm an expert in the history of self-help literature. So I was very interested to learn that when you were an undergrad, you fell in love with the 1968 self-help classic, The Greatest Salesman in the World, by Og Mandino. And, you know, self-help is such a familiar and beloved genre in American literature because it promises the secrets to happiness and success and ancient wisdom about what makes some rise and others fall. But what I really heard in your story, too, about self-help was that it gave you permission to take big chances.
Yep.
It gave you permission to believe that you could take a big risk and leave law as your chosen career path and go to film school.
So it was a time for me, I was coming on the end of my sophomore year in college. And the only thing I had ever thought I was going to be, what I was groomed to be in the family since I was 12 years old, was be a lawyer. I was always a great debater. I was a great arguer. I could argue both sides. I was, and we could outlast the family sometimes. And I mean, we started off with a joke about, gosh, damn it, make sure that boy's a lawyer. Good God. It turned into actually, hey, no, you're really going to be good at this. And I was like, criminal defense. That's a great, what a wonderful privilege of a job. Well, at the end of my sophomore year in college, I wasn't sleeping well with the idea for the first time. That book, it was the fact that it found me. It was very clear to me that I had a singular adventure that I was about to partake, and it was meant for me. And that gave me great courage and clarity and courage for the word.
Yes. You know, in all the interviews I've done about what felt purposeful about self-help or about like the experience of going to certain churches or like what made people feel chosen, I think was sometimes it was yes. the ability to, I think this is the experience we get when with just the joy of memoirs that we're able to look backwards and sort of hold bits of our biography up to the light and then just kind of enjoy them, like enjoy the feeling of being pulled towards something that became so deeply meaningful that it really changed us.
Well, that earlier on, I think we were offline at the time when I think you said, I'm going to introduce you and I hope you don't mind me talking about you in the third person. And I said, oh, I'm a big fan of the third person. I'll tell you why. And it's for this exact reason. I mean, it's an objective look at our subjectivity. So it's another means of awareness.
Yeah.
Now, where I understand why people go, oh, there's a claim that there's sometimes an arrogance that comes part and parcel with talking, saying your name in the third person. And there can be if that's what you're relying on. I don't believe it should be the primary way that we see ourselves, because we're then no longer the subject. We're actually, we see it all the time in today's world, especially with all the social media and the world through the big mirror. We're all almost living in the third person, projecting out in front of us. Well, how do I look? How's this going to be perceived?
Yeah.
What's the result instead of the process that we talked about? So the first person, if you're just in the first person, you're the subject. It's all process.
Yeah.
There is no objective view. But if your first person subjective is the primary way with which we move through the world and make choices and have our head down, we don't pop out to actually ask permission or say, hey, do I look as good as I feel? Because I sure feel good. You know what I mean? If that's the primary modus operandi, then I think it's very healthy to go, oh, let's have a look at how we look at McConaughey. You know, let's hop up on the Jumbotron and have a look from the Google eye in the sky at how we're doing. And that objectivity is actually what a memoir is, and writing a book, I guess, anyway, it is.
No, I totally agree. I'm a very sensitive person, and I always thought that maybe that porousness was a bad thing. Like, shouldn't I be more self-determining? Shouldn't I always know? And I don't know. I think maybe after I was so sick, and after I really began to appreciate the beauty of interdependence, I began to see how much of myself I could discover when I was allowed to see myself from the outside in. Mm. Like maybe sometimes when we're surrounded by the people, especially the people who love us and know both our beauty and our complete bullshit, like it's that moment where you get a minute to say, I think I feel even more like myself than I did before. And that's been one of the great joys of being kind of externally constituted.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I like about the objectivity or the third person is that sometimes I'm very subjective. If you read the book, many things, I just throw myself into it and go, I'm going to see what happens.
Yeah.
But also I'm very intentional with a lot of things of going, no, I'm going to write the headline first. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to write the story towards the headline. And that objectivity is part of almost the headline. Well, check out the headline, or I'm going to do a movie. I've always practiced this. Before I'll do a movie, I'll sit down with the director and the producers and say, what's the poster? Mm-hmm. Is it? And they go, oh, you're the lead character. It's a close-up of you on a silhouette. Well, that kind of lets me know that this is going to be a character-driven movie. If it's a wide shot, an impression, so to speak, that is, you know, three small figures cresting a mountain and you can't really tell who they are, well, then you go, oh, this is more of an epic story-driven movie. It gives me an idea what movie I'm in. As I like to say this, you know, before a movie, what album are we making? Are we making a rock album, a country album, a jazz album, a classical album? I just want to know. I don't need to know what the songs are. I just kind of want to know what genre I'm in.
Yeah.
And can we agree on that? That's a way of being objective. That's a way of seeing oneself in the third person, planting a future place to go to.
Yeah. Then you get to write it forwards and backwards. I like that. We have a lot of people in this community who really get a lot of gorgeous meaning out of that feeling that their gifts have really matched something in the world's needs. Mm. They don't just have a job, they have a calling. You're someone I think who really understands acting as a calling. What has that meant to you?
You know, in college, as I, when I first got started on my first job, Days Confused, I remember going, acting, it's all of the ologies. Theology, anthropology, psychology, it's all of the ologies. As I've grown, I still believe that to be true, but it's a way of communicating humanity, you know, in a biography. It's not my job to imitate someone. It's my job to emulate. And art emulates life. My best work is, as an actor, is not when I'm playing someone that is less myself. My best work is when I'm finding that part in myself, really tapping into it, that everybody has in them. That part of my own humanity, and through my vessel, I'm really emulating that through a character.
You know, I've heard a little bit of that too when we've been, interviewing. Like, I'm just thinking of all the folks that I've interviewed since the pandemic started, who have, who were, you know, trained as doctors or trained as trauma therapists, and part of what they describe in role making sounds really familiar in what you're saying, that if you discipline yourself into someone that you may not yet be, like, for example, someone who can stand in an emergency room and, you know, understand and then channel the chaos into a process, they're not necessarily less themselves. They become more somehow, even if what they're doing is not just them, you know, in a standard way. You're like, I didn't think I could be that person, but.
Well, I mean, look, I never thought about it, but I mean, this way, but maybe it's almost like in a way, a more literal version of what journaling does. We're all having a Socratic dialogue. So to write something down on paper, why does that relieve pain somewhat?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Why does, when you got a problem, going to someone and them just saying, hey, me too. Why does that all of a sudden take, pop the proverbial bubble? Because now you're not doing it alone.
Yeah.
Even writing something down on paper means, oh, I've just put it into matter on paper and it's outside of me. It untied the knot.
Yeah.
You know, play a role to do, I need to do this better and all of a sudden have more poise under pressure. Well, now you're doing it with that transcendent part of yourself. So now it's two people doing it.
Yeah.
Teamwork.
It's universalizing, and like part of so much of the loneliness that we're all experiencing, partly because the pandemic, partly because of, I think, our culture's hyper individualism. Mm-hmm. But there's a thing where when the great we gets to surface, it can be so liberating. So I know that you love bumper stickers, as you call them, like these tremendous amounts of meaning we can get from sayings. And I think it's so fun that you and I are in conversation. Sorry, I sounded very Canadian with that one. So I'm so happy you're here. And I am so thrilled.
You did sound quite Canadian on that one word in particular.
I'm a little Canadian. I am very Canadian. Okay. But it is very fun, you guys, that we are talking today, because I have these very violent and I think very intellectually sound overreactions to when people use pithy sayings, especially about suffering, because I got so many when I was really sick. So I got a lot of like, everything happens for a reason, or what goes around comes around, or what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Meaning is so tricky because we can't, assign it to anyone else. So I thought maybe we could trade some of our favorite sayings that have anchored us in our own life. Because, I think we both have some.
Let's do it.
Okay. Can I go first?
Yes, please.
All right. My family motto has always been, don't let the turkeys get you down. And we have that on like giant mugs and huge posters all over the house. And that really helped me because I was wildly unpopular. Don't let the turkeys get you down. My dad would say it when we were off to school. Don't let the turkeys get you down.
So the turkeys are the ones out there that are going, na 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 boo boo.
Yeah, gobble, okay. Gobble, gobble. Okay. Yeah, they're typically like a guy named Tyler who wants to present his Motley Crue findings in show and tell when you really had some thoughts about Beethoven you wanted to share that your class was not interested in, hypothetically.
I know the Tylers. God bless the Tylers and the Beethovens. Yes, 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 yeah. Yes.
So I like, don't let the turkeys get you down.
I understand. I got a bunch in there. I will say this one for response to that. And it comes from my college roommate from Alabama. went home on spring break and got to, it was the last time he was with his great grandfather. He came back from the trip and he was like, he's a thoughtful guy, my buddy Monty. And he was like, I was like, what'd you get? How was spring break? He goes, man, I had a great talk with my grandpappy one night on the porch. And he said something to me that's really sticking with me. I said, what? And he goes, well, I asked him, I said, grandpappy, what's the best advice you could give me? I said, what'd he say? He said, son, I've had thousands of crises in my life, and most of them never happened.
That's good. I like that. That makes me think, like, don't live too much in the future. You don't even, like, don't skip to the end. Okay, one of mine.
Yeah.
And this just started recently when I realized that I was going to have chronic cancer forever, and that was going to be a giant bummer and would make me difficult at parties. And then I began to just say, I hoped, in a slightly folksy voice, even though you really have the corner on the folksy market, I would say things like, life is a chronic condition.
A chronic condition? Yes.
Yeah, I thought it kind of worked.
Well, let me throw one on top of that, which is a great one. Once you know it's black, it ain't near as dark.
Well, that's good.
A chronic condition. Once you sit there and you go, oh shit, man, it's a chronic condition. Yeah. It's just what it is. It's not all easy street. Oh man, okay, this is going to be hard. Once you go, okay, I got that.
Yeah.
You're shaking hands with that fact. You gain courage. You turn yellow lights red. You actually blow through yellow lights and go, nope, making this one green, not even giving that crisis credit.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
But it's something with now with COVID, a lot of us have had to realize, look, don't be in denial that this is here. Some people are still trying to deny it. You're not going, no, it's real. It's here. Look it in the eye. We have been disrupted. Realize that. And then we can much easier sort of find our survival mechanisms to navigate our way through things when we realize that a hardship is actually a hardship.
I like that. I like the invitation to reality. You are a joy, and I'm so grateful for the way you were so just generous and present. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, really enjoyed it. Really, really have enjoyed it.
There's a great line I like in a really sweet movie called The Holiday, starring Kate Winslet. And she's sitting down with an old man named Arthur, who used to be a Hollywood director. And Arthur says, do you know what I've been thinking all night? What, she says, why I'm bothering you with all these questions? In the movies, he says, we have leading ladies and we have the best friend. You, I can tell, are a leading lady, but for some reason, you're behaving like the best friend. You're so right, she says. You're supposed to be the leading lady of your own life, for God's sake. And that is the joy of storytelling. We get the pure thrill of being the leading character of our own lives, of taking true things and lies and holding them up to say, is this how the story should go? Who am I? To others? To myself? Especially since we're so alone right now and struggling with the burden of extended loneliness, maybe now is a lovely time to return to that old diary and write some entries. What did our hero do today? Who did she help? What did he eat? What did it all mean? Because I guarantee that you, my lovelies, are a story worth telling. We are in the season of Lent, the time in the church calendar that challenges us all to turn ourselves toward the truth that the world is both terrible and beautiful. And somehow, God meets us there. I've been posting a video every morning on Instagram and Facebook, as well as sending out daily email reflections to help orient our day. So if that's your thing and you want to join along, visit katebowler.com/Lent to sign up for free. Today's episode was made possible by our lovely partners, the Lilly Endowment, the Duke Endowment, and Duke Divinity School, who support our Faith in Media project. We are so grateful for their generosity and investment in what we do. And of course, my team, who I am completely obsessed with, Jessica Ritchie, our executive producer, Harriet Putman, our associate producer, Keith Weston, our sound designer, and the rest of the Everything Happens crew who make this project so much fun. Dan Wells, AJ Walton, Mary Jo Clancy, JJ Dickinson, Lana Stewart, Kelly Dunlap, Aaron Lane, Jeb, and Sammy, thank you. This is Everything Happens with me, Kate Bowler.
Utilize this. Oh.
Well, I don't mind.
I'm not going over there.
No.
So if they don't call back. You know that song?
What?
On Skype, I walk around through the day going, ba-doom, doom, doom.
Oh my gosh. My son sings it. It's a song for like grandparents are calling. It's bedtime.